Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 13th, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is Al Trost. Session number is 98-1 and is titled Understanding Northern Ireland. Let's listen in.
The struggle I have yet to fight at the university, so but that's a personal thing. I'd like to just generally this week talk about the role of religion in societies, especially in societies that are torn by conflict. I might say kind of a personal word here that I initially got interested in Northern Ireland when I was at Valparaiso University Study Center in Cambridge, and colleague from graduate school asked me to help with research, and what he wanted me to do was to contact the churches in Northern Ireland and the clergy and pastors. He was Jewish and felt a bit uncomfortable doing that, and I agreed to help because it was a way to keep in touch professionally. And as I got into this and found that I could, because of my background, talk to the clergy, I became, I guess, more and more kind of agitated myself or uncomfortable that the church was, from at least the outside, seeming to play such a role in what seemed to me at the time to be fostering conflict rather than reconciliation. And that seemed to go against my understanding of the church's role from my American experience and my own Lutheran background. So I got more and more involved in the study of Northern Ireland. I started this in 1975, and I continue to this day, although again deaning keeps me away from Ireland more than perhaps it's desirable for both my scholarship and also just from my need. This is my Holden Village in a way. Northern Ireland, I mean, it may seem strange, but I've gotten so used to it, and it's so different than my own experience that I really do look forward to getting back to Ireland. I might also say that the more I got into this, the more I saw that Northern Ireland was being overstudied. They make disparaging remarks about researchers behind your back because they're just inundated with researchers. I mean, you don't have to speak a foreign language to go there. And so the Americans and British scholars all over the place, they're studying one aspect or another of the conflict. So I found that for my own legitimacy, I needed to immerse myself more in Irish studies. And so I've done a couple of leaves where I've just studied Irish culture. I went to University College Cork on one of my sabbaticals just to learn the Irish language and a bit about Ireland's pre-Christian and early Christian history, so I could at least show I knew a little bit about Ireland other than some of the stereotypes that are put in people's minds, I think, by the fighting. And I didn't plan it to happen this way, but Ireland is back in the news again, as you know, and as Susan said this morning, and in a prayer yesterday at the Eucharistic service, it has kind of pushed itself back into the foreground again. So even though I wasn't planning for it to have this immediacy, it kind of affirms my idea here of at least starting the week talking about Northern Ireland. What I'd like to do is to just give you some very basic background. Again, to get into this in a way that would satisfy Irish people, we'd have to spend several years just studying Irish history, and then they'd probably be satisfied that we could talk about the conflict, and I'll have to in about 5 minutes. And it's a very, very complicated kind of history. I thought I just might begin here. I've been reading a book for recreational purposes. This is a book called The Sign of the Cross by an Irish, a kind of backslidden, as a Baptist would say, Irish Catholic, Colm Tóibín, and he has just written a book called The Sign of the Cross. This has gotten pretty good reviews in the New York Times and New York Review of Books and so forth. What he is trying to do is to understand Catholicism in the contemporary world. He was brought up in Ireland, where I must say that the Catholic Church is maybe 20 years or 30 years behind in terms of liturgical practice and in some of their social pronouncements than the Catholic Church that you know in the United States or that one might find elsewhere in Europe. So he is in a sense an old-fashioned church. But this is a very kind of typical thing that you read, especially by Irish writers, but people commenting on the Russian scene. He's talking here about a pilgrimage that his aunts took, and he's trying to handle this. For him, it's almost a superstitious practice, but this is what he says. The past is recent, alive, easy to get in touch with in Ireland. I have a feeling that the ease with which the list of subscribers connects with the town, this is the town he's living in, 100 years later, is because there are hardly any surviving buildings in this town. History can be vivid to Irish people, Irish Catholics. And this is what we're seeing played out right now in Northern Ireland as the Orangemen march through Catholic neighborhoods. Probably some of you know why they're marching today. They're celebrating a military victory in 1689, when King William of Orange, having just taken over the British throne, was determined, prodded by Parliament, was determined to wipe out Catholic influences in what was at that time the United Kingdom, which included Ireland. And so he chased the preceding king, James II, the Stuart king, around the British Isles, and at this point happened to have his armies kind of cornered in Ireland. And they fought a battle on the Boyne River, a very small river, somewhat like the little river out here and back. For all the prominence that this has, the battle, so-called Battle of the Boyne, when I first visited it, I was kind of amazed that this was just a little kind of trickling stream. But anyway, the battle was of fairly immense proportions, and the Protestants under William of Orange, mainly English Protestants, handed the Jacobite forces, the forces of James II, a kind of major military defeat. Well, the Protestants, since about 1702, they didn't do it immediately, but since 1702, it has been traditional for them to march to celebrate this victory. And I mean, we don't do this kind of thing here even for World War II victories or Korean war battles, right? It's something we put in our past and forget in kind of a somewhat sometimes uncomfortable about this. And here in this country, and it's also on the Catholic side, I might say that these things are important, but this history is reenacted. For someone who's a historian, it's enacted very unrealistically and untrue to the facts. For instance, as the Protestants marched through the Catholic areas, and by the way, yesterday was the exact date of the victory in the battle, July 12th, in 1689. So that was a big marching day. That's why you had the firebombings. That's why things came to more of a head yesterday. The history is somewhat inaccurately reported. For instance, they have all the Protestants on their banners on white horses. They're almost all dressed in 18th century dress because the dress from the last part of the 17th century was less flamboyant. And they would have been dressed in black for one thing, because that was kind of the color that was in vogue in 1689. So they dressed them up in feathered hats and this kind of thing. And they have overemphasized the evil on the one side and overemphasized the good on the other. So it's not in any respect historically accurate, somewhat like Parson Weems' story of of George Washington chopping down the cherry tree, not meant perhaps even by the people who started it to be a realistic account of the history. Well, for those of you who are more mature like I am in age and not necessarily demeanor, you probably think the troubles in Northern Ireland have been going on for a long time. At the level that they are right now, it has not really been going on for centuries, as sometimes newspaper articles have it. The present troubles, as the Irish call them, started in 1969, when the Catholics, feeling very much oppressed, as African Americans were in our own country, watching the news, decided that the Martin Luther King civil rights kind of strategy of peaceful protest and marching might work in Ireland to get them fair employment, fair housing. So they began a series of marches, mainly at first just in very small kind of neighborhood settings. But in one kind of spectacular march in 1969, they marched from one major city. I have a map up here. I'm not going to stand at the map. But the two major cities in Northern Ireland, the ones that you usually read about, are Belfast, which has historically been the capital or government center, and Londonderry over here on the other side of Northern Ireland. There's not a whole lot of area we're talking about here. This is about 90 miles from one town to another. But the Catholic civil rights people marched from Belfast to Londonderry. And this provoked the kind of thing that we've seen in the news in the last couple of days, rock-throwing kind of incident, Molotov cocktails. And then, to kind of aggravate the situation even more, the police were called out. And just as, again, this looks a lot like the United States, for instance, in the South, in the 1960s, when the police come out, of course, they're all Protestants, because that's the Catholics never thought that it was loyal to join the police force because it was Protestant, much as African Americans often stayed away from the police forces in the United States, especially in the South, because this was a mark of kind of compliance with the authorities of the day. So the police came out, and of course they were not objective in dealing with this. They protected the marchers from the people protesting the march, exactly what's happening now in Northern Ireland, as again the marchers try to go through Catholic neighborhoods. They are being protested against. The police get into the middle of this. And still in Northern Ireland, even though there's been a lot of progress over the last two or three years, the police force is basically Protestant. And even though I believe, because I've talked to a number of the policemen, they're trying to do a professional job, they're not seen as doing a professional job because they're all Protestants, or almost all Protestants. I think about 3.1% of the police force in Northern Ireland is Catholic, and a third of the population is Catholic. So this whole spate of troubles that we are presently seeing in Northern Ireland is about 30 years old. This is, in a sense, almost an anniversary year for the beginning of the troubles. In the 1930s and 1940s, things were placid in the way that things were peaceful in the American South in the 30s and 40s. Northern Ireland especially was very much caught up in fighting World War II. Ireland, as you may know, the map here is divided into two parts. The southern part is a separate country, basically since 1921, and the six counties in the north are part of the United Kingdom, along with Scotland, Wales, and England. And because Ireland was neutral, they hated the British so much that they didn't want to come in on their side in World War II. Northern Ireland became then the first port of security for the Allied convoys crossing the North Atlantic, trying to escape the U-boats, trying to escape the German submarines. And so the Catholic and Protestant populations in Ireland were really kind of on the Allied side in the war. This made it possible for them to cooperate and forget about any kinds of antagonisms they had. And really into the middle of the 1950s, one would have seen a very placid society, but it was not an equal society. I mean, that has to be said. The Catholics were, like, many blacks in the American South, living in a state of some oppression and subjugation. They didn't get the best jobs. They certainly didn't get the best houses. So they tried to remedy this in 1968 and 69 by this series of marches, where they turned violent so fast that the British needed to send in many more troops. And then from 1972 onward, the conflict became more the conventional Irish against the British. The Protestants more or less retreated out of the public eye in 1972 because the British Army was more or less carrying on their fight for them. And so you didn't see the kind of thing you're seeing now with Protestants flinging firebombs, for instance, at people from the other community. You have kind of stages here, 69 to 72. Not real violent in terms of loss of life, but this was a period of Catholics trying to burn out Protestants and vice versa. It did even more to segregate the communities. If you would visit Belfast, today it's not so apparent, but up until about 3 years ago, the neighborhoods are actually cordoned off from one another. They often have barbed wire barriers between them. This is a police measure to keep people from hurting the other side and then fleeing back into their own neighborhood. So you have checkpoints. It's kind of like, in that sense, a war zone. Now, in the last 3 years, again, much of this has been dismantled because it was considered to be doing more harm than good. But the firebombings did have the effect of putting Protestants together with almost no Catholics in the neighborhood, and Catholics with almost no Protestants in the neighborhood. They each go to their separate schools. The Catholic Church in Ireland has said that it is the obligation of Catholic parents to send their children to Catholic schools. So the Catholics go to parochial schools. The Protestants then have the public schools all to themselves. So they, in effect, become Protestant schools. There's no separation of state, church and state in United Kingdom generally. And so perfectly permissible to have religion in the schools. In fact, it's mandated by British law to have at least 1 hour a week on religion. Well, the Protestants go a little farther than that. They usually have 1 hour a day. And it is Protestant, basically a kind of Protestant theology that's taught, and not one that would be real familiar with you from today. It might be something like you experienced if you were a child in the 1930s or 1940s. It's that kind of theology, very much kind of based on Bible and biblical stories. But they're not told the way they are in the Catholic school, so that's something pushing the populations apart. And then the other thing that really pushes populations apart is the intimidation by paramilitaries, they're called. They're basically terrorist guerrillas on either side that make it very difficult for somebody who even wants to engage in a reconciling activity, because you're liable to become then the target yourself of some of the violence. And where the paramilitaries started mainly on the Catholic side, now what we're seeing in the news are paramilitaries on the Protestant side that are just as active. Many times I've ridden with taxicab drivers and that who will have like a gang symbol up in the window indicating which community they're from and what their connection is to that community so that they're not harassed by their own side. And the taxi cabs at the town center line up according to these symbols and will only drive into their own neighborhoods. You won't get a Protestant taxi cab driver to drive you into a Catholic neighborhood and vice versa, usually. Now, there are some who maybe are at certain times are so desperate for the money that they'll do it, but they won't take you deep into the neighborhood. You'll have to have an address on a main street for them to cooperate in this. So that's the situation as it's existed in Northern Ireland, basically until the mid-1980s, when the British government decided that it was like the Vietnam War was for us, that they just could not sustain this kind of commitment in terms of military troops, in terms of what it was doing to their reputation. So a conservative government under Margaret Thatcher began to move to trying to impose a peace from the outside by talking to the Irish government in Dublin here. And this resulted in an agreement in 1985 known as the Hillsborough Agreement, which was the kind of governing framework for cooperation between Catholics and Protestants at the official level until just this last spring when a new one was set in place. So the British government, where before they were very supportive of the Protestants because the Protestants had helped them, especially in World War I. One specific battle, you see how I get into little dead ends here, and I need to keep on the main course, but in World War I, the British suffered a tremendous loss of life. We don't realize it so much because we were only in the war a couple of months, really, in World War I. But the British were in there from the beginning, and they suffered tremendous loss of life, especially at a battle called the Battle of the Somme. And they needed to replenish their troops, and so the Irish Protestants were right there to take the stead, stand in back of the fallen British soldiers, and they took a tremendous toll, or that they lost a tremendous number of people. So the British have felt kind of guilty about abandoning them because they were so important in World War I and in World War II, I should say, too. So they don't want to just pull out, even though you'd be hard-pressed to go around England in pubs and whatever and find English people who really are very much in support of the Protestants these days. They're just not. But again, there's this kind of feeling of guilt that they can't abandon these people who once stood with them and behind them in these two wars, especially. So the British want to get out. They wanted to get out ever since they had to commit so many troops. And I should say half of the casualties in Northern Ireland have been British security forces, half the people killed. Now I know that again today the news is about the firebombing and the three children killed, and they're certainly innocent civilians, but most of the majority of the loss of life has been by the British security forces. So this is all kind of prompted the present activity. The breakthrough for the agreement that you all read about in April was a Labour government taking over in Britain. The Labour government feels less beholden to the Irish Protestants. The Unionists, especially in the last Thatcher government, and then in the John Major government, they needed the Unionist votes, the Protestant votes, in the House of Commons in order to stay in power. And so they were very reluctant to do anything that aggravated the Protestants. When Labour got in this last year, the Labour government in Britain, they have less connections. They don't need the Irish Protestant votes. They don't even need the Irish Catholic votes. And so they have been able to set off in newer and more aggressive ways to try to impose, again, a solution from the outside. It's very important to say that very little of the activity that you saw this year has come from inside Ireland, inside Northern Ireland. Most of it has been imposed, and you can be sure that whenever the British politicians or the Irish politicians talk to their counterparts in Northern Ireland, Protestants, Catholics, they are doing a lot more threatening than we see in the press. They're telling them, you either, you know, attend these talks, you either accept this agreement, or we will pull out and you'll have a bloodbath on your hands. So, again, to me, that was always an abdication of responsibility by the churches, at least that's how I read it. So I began then to actually talk to clergy, to go to church meetings, to try to find out what the role of the church was in all of this. Maybe I should stop there for a few minutes and see if you have any questions about just the kinds of facts of the situation or what's going on in Northern Ireland before I move on to talk about the role of Christians, the role of churches, things that have dismayed you or bothered you about that situation. Yes.
I have a question about the march right now. Is that the same march from Belfast to...
No. The one we're seeing, at least the provocation right now, is in two towns in the Lurgan Valley, Portadown and Lurgan itself. They're right here and here. And if you look at that little map that I handed out, you can see that... I don't think I have any more. I'm sorry. I did 20, and there are more than 20 here today. So the white areas are the areas where the Protestants are in the majority. In fact, the white areas are where they're in the strongest majority. The darker the color, the more Catholics predominate. And Lurgan and Portadown are on the kind of dividing line between the clearly Protestant areas and the Catholic areas. And so these have always been kind of hot spots for communal conflict. Now, the British troops haven't been in this area very much, but this has been where the early cross-communal violence has persisted in a way that it did not in the rest of Northern Ireland. So the march was, the first one, the one that caused the trouble 2 weeks ago, was in Portadown, which is a town of about 40,000 people, very depressed. The factories that were there were linen factories. They're long since gone. And there's a lot of unemployment in the town. And the Orangemen, Orange again for William of Orange, the king who won the 1689 battle, the Orangemen decided that even though this peace agreement had been signed, even though the pressure was on them to try to be more reconcilers, they decided that, you know, history couldn't die and that they were going to push the march. And they always marched through the Catholic areas because it's a celebration of a victory. Again, we would do that in our country if we did it. We would do it for the people who were victorious. But in Ireland, again, because history is alive, they do it like they're fighting a battle all over again. And these parades are something to see, these orange parades. The marching season starts about the 20th of June and goes to about August 18th. And there'll be certain other times during the year when there'll be a march, but these are the provocative times. And of course, the peak was yesterday, July 12th. And so the Orangemen will put a parade together. What it is the Orange Order is formed into lodges, like Masons would be in our country. And they're primarily, for most of the year, social places, places you can drink on Sundays. Protestants aren't supposed to drink. Almost all of them do. They can drink in the pubs on 6 days of the week, but on the seventh day, the Protestant churches are strong enough that they have kept the pubs closed in Northern Ireland on Sunday. And so the Orangemen retreat to this place and drink, and they drink before the parades, I should say. It is a sense kind of courageous of them, because they go right into hostile territory. They could be hit by a rock or something, occasionally even sniped at with bullets, but they go in here, and it's a very provocative parade. There's one lodge after another. They all line up. Usually they support one another. So if the march is in East Belfast, the lodges will come from all over Northern Ireland to march with them. And they beat drums called lambeg drums, which they're bass drums that are about as high as I am. And they strap these on, and the only way you can march with them is to arch your back like that, and they walk for miles. It's kind of like in, you know, some Catholic countries where, you know, people are beating themselves as they're walking through the streets. It is, in that sense, a kind of ritual of self-punishment. And they strap the mallets around their wrists, and by the end of a 3 or 4 mile parade that's bleeding, the leather straps have dug into their skin. But they, you know, are lubricated for this, and they have very militant music. If you've heard records of American music from the Revolutionary War, that's the kind of music they played, fife and drum kind of things. Some parts of Ireland, accordions are important, so they'll include in accordions. It's a sound you won't forget. If you're musical, you may even shudder. It's not what I would call kind of compatible combination, but again, it's a, and the music is always a march of some kind, and they go right into the Catholic neighborhoods, and they'll do this until about August 18th, and then it stops for another year, much to the relief of the security forces and the Catholics. And each year, of course, there is some expectation by the Catholics that it's going to stop. Because, you know, it's at least what we hear in the news is that, you know, there's more reconciliation. There's an agreement now. I brought it along today in case somebody is really having trouble getting to sleep. You might want to read it. This is the whole kind of legal document that was agreed to in April of last year, or this year, rather. And so that's a false impression in a way. It's not, things are not that that much more peaceful than they were in the neighborhoods. Certainly, again, you know, at the level of the elites or leadership, there is some activity there.
Are these parades a male thing, or is it both men and women?
The women cheer their men on. I mean, it's not, but it's again kind of old-fashioned on the sides. Usually, there'll be a clergyman. This is one of the things that I was interested in. There's a clergyman with each lodge. They're the chaplains of the lodge. Presbyterians or Church of Ireland. Those are the two denominations in Northern Ireland. The Presbyterian Church came over with Scottish settlers who came over beginning in the reign of Elizabeth I in the 1500s. And they're Presbyterians, and then the people who have kind of served in Ireland, the civil servants, the military people, through 700 or 800 years, they're the ones who are their descendants are the backbone of the Church of Ireland, which is the same as the Church of England, same as our Episcopalian Church. It's part of the general Anglican communion. But there'll always be a clergyman, usually Presbyterian or Anglican, who marches with the Orange Order. Yes?
Is it possible to separate religion from nationalism over there? Is it strictly Catholic versus Protestant, or is it the Irish hate the British because it's not the same situation like in Bosnia?
You're right. I mean, that's, you know, generally the religions are part of the nationalist symbolism. Especially in the Catholic case, there's very little theological going on, very little actual religious thought going on the side of conflict on the Catholic side. For the Catholics especially, it's a nationalist anti-colonial struggle. And the reason the Catholic Church gets involved is the Polish and Irish Catholic churches are really the only two in Europe that were not on the side of the old regime, not on the side of the elites. They were truly, that is the Polish and Irish Catholic churches, were truly churches of the people. And so to be Catholic in Ireland is to be on the popular side. So certainly on that side, very little theological going on, at least on the conflict side. For the Protestants, it's a bit more of a kind of religious struggle, because for them, they're resisting Catholicism. And the Catholic Church has done just enough in Ireland to kind of give a little bit of substance or credence to that. They were one of the last churches to adopt the Second Vatican Council reforms. So their position on mixed marriages is very much like it was in the United States, for instance, 50 years ago. When a Protestant and Catholic get married, the only place that that marriage can be made solemn is in the Catholic Church. And the priest, as what happened around the Catholic world, will insist that the children be brought up in the Catholic faith. And the Protestant has to take an oath still in Ireland that they will do nothing to change the religion either of their spouse or of the children. They have to promise that the children be sent to Catholic schools. So that's just enough, you know, to convey to the Protestants that maybe there is something here that we need to resist.
Is the fact that John Paul, Pope John Paul is from Poland, contributing to that? I mean, he hasn't really done much to stop what's going on.
No. He has been to Ireland, I think, 3 times now. And when he comes, a tremendous audience always attends him. And he has, I think, made the usual speeches against the violence, homilies against the violence, and in favor of reconciliation. I would say progressive clergymen on both sides in Northern Ireland are always disappointed that he doesn't do more in favor, again, of peace and reconciliation. But I think there is a kind of cross-sympathy here. I mean, the Pope comes out of the same kind of Catholic Church as Irish Catholics do. I've gotten kind of into the religious thing, so go ahead. Yeah.
Did the ratification of the agreement mean anything?
Well, it means that Britain and Ireland are now committed as countries to moving toward a settlement. The British have pledged to pull their troops out. There's not a specific timetable. It's not like Russia pulling its troops out of Chechnya, but they have agreed to pull back. They've agreed to merge some parts of the security forces. Intelligence, for instance, is going to be merged. That is British Army intelligence and Irish Army intelligence. They've been doing a bit of this anyway on the informal level. It's going to mean some differences. Again, outside the people, it's kind of the hearts of the people that really, again, need changing. I mean, it's a cliche. It's on that, again, that not as much progress has been made. That, again, I think the activity of Christian churches is very relevant. But there's not a lot of change that's happened. But I see some, yes.
I presume you've read Frank Court's book, Angels Ashes.
Yes.
Would that be a pretty accurate depiction of the poverty that the Catholics suffer?
Yes, I think that's a very good book. I mean, there are some really good things in the popular culture on Ireland. I would not recommend Leon Uris's Trinity. Some of you have seen that. It's a kind of long, interesting novel in many respects. But no, Angela's Ashes is very good. There's a movie that just came out this last year, Some Mother's Son. Didn't play probably in your town, but it was released by, I think, Warner Brothers, and that was about the hunger strike, and that was fairly accurate. And there was another movie in the name of the Father, which was pretty accurate. The Harrison Ford stuff is very inaccurate. Pardon me?
What about Michael Collins?
It's interesting that the group that's most opposed to that is the IRA, because it presents them in a very unfavorable light. The Michael Collins movie, it's about the time of the Irish War of Independence against the British. Michael Collins was one of the leaders of the Irish Republican Brotherhood, who then moved for peace. Many IRA people felt betrayed by that, and so that's what the movie's about. But it's accurate historically. Again, it doesn't put the IRA in good light, and so the Republican press in this country has been giving it lousy reviews. Most of the Irish press in the United States is very pro-Republican, even IRA at times. Was there some other question? Yeah. Okay, let me just say a bit about the churches then. Let me pass this out. After hearing the Bible study today by Terry, I was reluctant to do this because but it does relate. And again, I only made 20 copies, so let me send a few around over here. And here. I'll have to keep one of these. One of the things I did after visiting Ireland for about 10 years is I wanted to, because I perceived at that time that being Christian, of course, meant many different things, and this was one of the themes of Terry's beginning Bible session today. He was talking about images of God and how we all have different images, but they're also related to some of the subcultures we come out of. And I didn't hear this before I wrote this, so I have a different kind of map here, conceptual map. This is from Martin Marty's book, A Nation of Behaviors, probably out of print now, but he has chapters on the various kinds of religious expression in the United States and what their implications are for the society, and the category that I'm sure most of us would want to place ourselves in is the mainline category. This is being a kind of active member, at least a church attending member of one of the mainline denominations, doing some things for the neighbor. In Ireland, that meant engaging in some reconciling activity. What I did was to formulate an interview schedule that captured these various modes of religious expression. Evangelical fundamentalist, charismatic, and then the civil religion I've here used to mean people who don't attend churches but still affirm some of the symbols from the tradition. There's still, for instance, the Catholics will still talk about confession, and they won't go to it, but they still will talk about it. For them, Mass is still important for members of the community, although they probably themselves are not regular Mass attenders. So it's a kind of symbolic expression without much content or behavior. So in any case, those percentages add across the rows, and these are just, I didn't, because I often present this kind of thing at elder hostels, and that I didn't want to get into tents and hundreds of percentages and tests of significance and that kind of thing. I have to do that for my social science colleagues, but I figured here it wasn't appropriate either. So, about 70% of the Catholics, and this is a high church attending in a Catholic country, again, showing the popular roots of Catholicism, about 70% of Catholics regularly attend Mass and are in some kind of church organization besides just coming to church and, you know, doing good for hungry or poor neighbors, that kind of thing. There are, of course, very few evangelical fundamentalist Catholics. There's no need to be because the church is so conservative there. There isn't the kind of reaction we've had, and small reaction in our country with traditional Catholics. There is a strong charismatic movement in the Catholic Church. These are mainly younger people who, again, don't understand the practice of novenas and retreats and that they see their parents and grandparents and are, there is a proliferation of special Irish saints besides in Ireland, and some of the young people have rejected this, trying to get back to a more kind of simple and maybe even in some respects primitive Christianity. And then about 20% of the Catholics, and most of these are the RA members, or the RA members are mostly English because they've been excommunicated from the church. The Catholic Church will not tolerate professed terrorists that they excommunicate them. So when you see Jerry Adams on television and that, he will occasionally go to Mass, but he, from the Catholic Church's standpoint, Danny Morrison's the same way, are no longer members of the Catholic Church. Notice Presbyterians, much like kind of mainline in the United States, I suppose, not so much in the Presbyterian community, but if you take all Protestants, about 25% of them are in this mainline category. Again, there's a very strong element of evangelical fundamentalism in Presbyterian Church, and that's one of the roles the church plays in not, I think, a very positive way in Ireland. What I mean here is just a kind of simple proclamation of the gospel, very little attempt to move outside in terms of social implications. The attendance at church is done because it's seen in a, we would say in Lutheran terms, a legalistic way. You know, this is what's required to go to church. Many of the people in this category go to church twice on the Sabbath. Protestant churches in Ireland still have two services. So that's one of the, not that people in the other categories wouldn't do that, but again, it's a kind of following the rules. And then not many Protestants are charismatic, especially not in Presbyterian church. But a lot of them don't go to church. With all this business about closing the pubs, you'll still see a lot of Protestants in Protestant neighborhoods out picnicking and whatever on Sunday morning, reading the papers. That's a big thing in Ireland. They blow all over the park. So, and then the Church of Ireland, which tends to be a little more moderate in its official position than the Presbyterian Church, more reconciliation-oriented. You see that across there. What many people would say are the troublemakers are the last group down on the evangelical fundamentalist list. Notice I only got 10,000. These are the followers of Ian Paisley, if some of you have seen him on television. He has founded a church, it's his own church, called the Free Presbyterian Church, which I've looked a lot at this and read a lot of books on it, and I actually had some long conversations with Paisley himself. His theology we'd call in this country more a kind of Baptist theology. They have adult baptism, for instance, in the church, and its style to attend a worship service is not what you would experience in most of Presbyterian churches. It's more like a kind of independent Baptist church. In fact, he's got a church, Paisley's got a church he calls Martyrs Memorial, and he's got Martin Luther there. Martin Luther may not be happy with that kind of placement, and John Calvin, of course, and Zwingli. And then he's got Bob Jones as the last statue there. He got an honorary degree from Bob Jones University in South Carolina, and finds a lot of connection to what I would call more kind of hardline fundamentalism in our country, not even Falwell. I would think it's a kind of more basic, rural, southern-based kind of fundamentalism. A lot of interchange. His daughters went to Bob Jones University. Bob Jones regularly preaches in his congregation. In the older days, Carl McIntyre, Billy James Hardis, those people familiar with the kind of old Christian right in this country will recognize those names. So that's, but he not only doesn't say anything positive about getting along with the neighbor, he says a lot of negative stuff. I thought about bringing my tapes along, but I thought enough gloom and doom anyway, just in talking about this topic, and I didn't want to do this. But he often will use some of the, again, metaphors from the Bible, like the Whore of Babylon is one of his favorites, to talk about Catholics. And that, again, doesn't do anything. Not that a lot of Protestants are in church, in his churches especially, but that's the kind of thing that gets conveyed in a, you know, soundbite on the news. And for Protestants who are just kind of overwhelmed by all the changes, and now the latest change is, you know, having to get along with Catholics, this is enough to convince them that if they at least don't cooperate with the present movement toward peace, they may be doing it with some religious justification. Again, he's, if one listens to him for a long time, he's got a very kind of complicated thing, which a lot of Protestants would like to hear. He is very much against drinking, for instance, very much against betting. And gaming shops, betting shops are one of the major recreational activities for Protestants in Northern Ireland. Well, you know, I probably have done too much talking today about this. We're just about out of time. Let me say a word on behalf of the Christians that are working against very significant forces to try to bring peace. There is a reconciling movement called the Cori Mila Movement. Some of you may have even heard of it. It's part of the Cross of Nails community. This is a Protestant-run reconciliation center on the north coast of Northern Ireland, where they have for years been taking Protestants and Catholics who are immediately affected by the violence, victims, families of victims of the violence, families of the security forces, and they've been putting them in a kind of Holden Village kind of setting, common meals, common worship. I was thinking last night when, you know, we talked about the Holden Village tradition in worship, there is a Cori Mila hymn book, there's Cori Mila prayers. In fact, you often see this used in the United Kingdom, especially in Protestant churches. I've even seen it used in the United States. We use it in Valparaiso once a year when we celebrate our affiliation with the Cross of Nails community. So this group has been going on. The Charismatics have a number of renewal centers or reconciliation centers. And then there just is the kind of work that some of the mainline churches are doing, mainline church members that you do, going out and trying to identify the hungry and delivering meals to them regardless of which side of the denominational barrier they're on. So the church, there is a witness there. It's drowned out oftentimes, though, by the Paisley witness, or drowned out sometimes by the conservatism of the Catholic Church in Ireland. But there are a lot of people working on a kind of day-to-day basis to try to bring reconciliation. And it's mainly a kind of person-to-person thing. It's there's not a lot that you, and that's why you don't read about it. There's not a lot that's going on in terms of ecumenical dialogue, and that they tried that in the 50s. And the result was that the Irish Protestant churches left the World Council of Churches. In fact, the Presbyterians have switched the initials. They say they belong to something called the CCW, the Campaign for a Concerted Witness to Reform Truth. And so it's this kind of counter, really, to what ecumenism stands for, represents.
In the
agreement, was there conversation about how children are schooled?
No. Well, I'm sure there was conversation, but it did not come out in the agreement. Because it got too much at, I think, again, the kind of heart of the religious differences, and that the governments are trying to put down. I think they would have to go up against the Catholic Church, for instance, and the kind of conservatism of the Catholic bishops to say anything about integrated education.
It seems like in the States that has been a significant way to bridge differences between peoples. And I was just wondering, as you said, the elite and the leaders have had conversations about that.
There are always a few courageous people. There is an independent school movement in Northern Ireland called the Lurgan School Movement, which does aim to have Protestants and Catholics, but it's private. It gets some subsidy from the state, but it's a private movement. And they maybe have 9 schools in Ireland, elementary schools. But it's not made very many inroads, again, because I think of the stance, especially of the Catholic Church. And the Protestants would say, well, what do we have to reform? You know, we're the school system. Just like in the South, the school system is Catholic. It's called the National School Movement. And, you know, all the national schools are, well, not all of them. There are some in Dublin that are Protestant, but most of them are Catholic schools. Yes?
How do you see it ending, or do you see it ending, or is it going to be just up to the people, and so far they don't want it?
There are some things happening that, you know, that just are going to happen. One is that the birth rate of Catholics is about 45% higher than the birth rate among Protestants. So that even since I've been studying it, when I first started in studying Northern Ireland, the Catholic percentage of the population was about 30%. It's now, my figures are even out of date on that one sheet there, it's now up to about 38%. So that the Catholic percentage is increasing. The agreement says that the Irish and British government will abide by the will of the majority of the people. Right now the will is a Protestant will. But by about 2040, and I hope we don't have to wait that long, but by 2040, it's projected the Catholics will outnumber the Protestants. Also, because of the fact that the agreement was signed, the Protestant emigration rate out of the country is higher than the Catholic immigration rate, which has always been much higher, as we know in our own population here in the United States, right? A lot of Irish Catholics here.
There's been a small but growing trend of people that have grown up outside of Ireland in America and whatnot, in several other countries, to move back there because the jobs are better, kind of get back to their roots and stuff. How much of an impact is that going to have on the situation?
I think the greatest impact is going to be because of the common market or the European Union, where Irish people have, and I think that's the important thing, is that the current generation that's born in Ireland gets out and then comes back more than across generations. And I think that has been a very important development because they get to other countries, they get into more modern cultures. A lot of them are computer programmers and because the Irish are good at that kind of thing. They have a very substantial mathematics component to their education. So I think that's going to have some, the common market has some influence. Ireland used to be the most depressed economy. Now it's one of the fastest growing economies in the common market, so, or in the European Union. So, you know, I mean, those are, again, things that are going to change the situation a bit, modify it, moderate it.
These are people that grew up or that were born in Ireland, been educated, moved out, whether they were born in America or Canada or whatnot, and then they're saying they want to go back.
Yeah. One of the problems there is that the Irish, especially the Irish American community, there's been a lot written on this, and you know, I haven't tried to get into this, but a lot of Irish writers talk about the guilt of the Irish who are here. Typically what happened in the famine is that families would get all their money together and send one of their sons, usually, not the one who was going to inherit the property, but maybe the second or third son, to America. And so that person escaped the death associated with the famine. And so that branch of the family has always felt a kind of guilt. And one of the ways that the guilt is compensated for is to be more Republican than the Republicans in Ireland. A Republic, I mean, in favor of a united Ireland, a united Catholic Ireland. And so I've been studying the Irish-American press, and it is very, again, as I was saying before, very Republican. I mean, they pretty much take a kind of Sinn Féin line, usually, on developments. Well, we're out of time, and thank you.
Thank you.